thoughts on this and where these negotiations stand.
As a matter of fact, that I've been following the news about this from the Israeli media sources and from the Palestinian media sources as well. That specific request was not made by the Israeli security forces or security agencies in the past. Now Netanyahu is inventing something new for the sake of just continuing the delay. It looks like this delay is taking place for some purely political reasons, where Netanyahu is interested in prolonging the war. They have disputes, they have issues. One of the top leaders is now in the USA. Netanyahu is busy calling the Blinken and calling other people, telling them that it is an unauthorized trip. It looks like there is something that is internally happening in the Israeli political arena that Netanyahu wants to stop and prevent from happening. And that's why everything that he wants to do eventually reflects on the Palestinians. Now more killing, more displacement, now refusing the request to provide some names, now asking to provide some names. So I think we will see a great deal of procrastination like the one that we have been seeing for the past few months. Netanyahu is interested in his personal safety when it comes to his political career, political life, and I think that's why even the security, Israeli security forces that are not being able to end this military confrontation with the Palestinian factions in Gaza are now trying to, through the political means, to come to a, would say, honorable end for this, but they are failing to do so.
You're talking about Benny Gantz being in Washington now to meet with today Kamala Harris, Tony Blinken she'll be meeting with, and other officials. I wanted to finally ask you about the issue of famine, about the number of children who are dying of hunger and dehydration, and how the Palestinians are dealing with this at this point.
Well, according to the statistics that were released by the Palestinian Minister of Health, around 1 million Palestinians have developed some diseases of any kind, be them some diseases that have to do with the digestive system, with the respiratory system, with the upper respiratory system, which is indicative of the quality of life, where quality of life has reached in Gaza. And what is the situation of the public health? When you don't have water desalination plants, when you destroy the water purification systems, when you destroy the solar panels that are on top of the houses of the people, when you destroy the heavy vehicles that are used by the municipalities to remove the waste, when you are destroying everything that has to do with the life of the Palestinians, this result is normal and is projected, and it will continue to deteriorate. Now with the children, 18 children have died in northern Gaza. More children are dying in southern Gaza. People cannot get decent food for their children. When people are drinking the water is polluted and it causes them some serious public health issues. And now the children are the most vulnerable people within the community. We have 1 million child in Gaza. 1 million child that do not have appropriate shelter, do not have appropriate feeding systems, they don't have appropriate water systems, and they end up consuming water that is polluted, food that is polluted. They end up exposed. The twin that were killed yesterday, they were just twins, they were children. They were killed with their father. So they were deprived from the right to live, and they are still deprived from the right to access decent water, shelter, and food supplies. So this is the situation in Gaza as it is. It is an ongoing suffering because of the fact that Israeli occupation denied them the right to be treated as humans. This is the whole issue.
Akram al-Safari, we want to thank you so much for being with us. A Gaza-based journalist speaking to us today from Rafah. Please be safe. When we come back, thousands gathered Friday in Moscow for the funeral of opposition leader Alexei Navalny, who died in an Arctic prison last month. Stay with us.
To cut me off. God,
Igor Stravinsky's A Sermon, A Narrative, and a Prayer, performed by CBC Symphony Orchestra. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to Russia, where thousands gathered Friday in Moscow for the funeral of the Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, weeks after he died February 16th in an Arctic prison at the age of 47. The funeral was live-streamed on Navalny's YouTube channel. This is a mourner outside the funeral.
I came to remember a good man who was deprived of his life. His family was deprived of love, of everything. We had hopes for him. It's very unfortunate. We are always visiting Nemtsov, and now we have one more place to visit. God forbid more places like these occur. We are very worried.
Navalny's family held a funeral service at a Moscow church with his body displayed in an open casket. His mother and father were at the ceremony. Navalny's wife, Yulia Navalnaya, is outside of Russia and could not attend. Neither could his children. Navalnaya has accused Putin of murdering her husband and delaying the release of his body to cover it up. The family reportedly wanted to bury Navalny Thursday, the same day as Russian President Vladimir Putin's annual State of the Nation address. Several foreign diplomats attended the funeral, including the U.S., German, and French ambassadors to Russia. The Kremlin's warned against unauthorized gatherings, and the Russian rights group OVD Info reported, quote, at least 67 arrests in 16 towns Friday, including six arrests in Moscow. Overall, the organization reports about 400 people have been detained at memorials and rallies across Russia since Navalny's death. Earlier today in Geneva, the UN human rights chief, Volker Türk, addressed the situation in Russia while giving his global update to the UN Human Rights Council. He expressed concerns about the persecution of Navalny and others in the run-up to Russia's presidential elections that start March 15th.
In the Russian Federation, the authorities have further intensified their repression of dissenting voices prior to this month's presidential election. Several candidates have been prevented from running due to alleged administrative irregularities. The death in prison of opposition leader Alexei Navalny adds to my serious concerns about his persecution. Since the onset of Russia's war in Ukraine, thousands of politicians, journalists, human rights defenders, lawyers, and people who have simply spoken their minds on social media have faced administrative and criminal charges, and this trend appears to have worsened in recent months, with many cultural figures being targeted. Last month, a new bill passed into law that further punishes people convicted of distributing information deemed to be false about Russia's armed forces, as well as people who seek to implement decisions by international organizations that the Russian Federation does not take part in. I urge a swift and comprehensive review of all cases of deprivation of liberty that result from the exercise of fundamental freedoms, as well as an immediate end to the repression of independent voices and the legal professionals who represent them. The future of the country depends on an open space.
For more, we're joined in Berkeley, California by Ilya Budryatskis, a Russian historian and political theorist who was previously based in Moscow and recently joined the University of California, Berkeley as a visiting scholar. He's a member of the Russian anti-war Posle.media, a leftist online platform founded after the 2022 Russian invasion of Ukraine. He's the author of the award-winning book Dissidents Among Dissidents, Ideology, Politics, and the Left in Post-Soviet Russia. His new piece for Jacobin is titled Alexei Navalny Taught Russia's Opposition How to Mobilize. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Ilya. Can you talk about what you understand took place on Friday and the lead up to the funeral itself, how if people felt threatened, and the message that you think this funeral was to the world?
So thank you so much. So the first thing to say that the Russian authorities did a lot to prevent this funeral to happen, because they hided the body. They tried to prevent any public funerals in Moscow. So all this story happened during the week. And finally, they decided that it will be easier to make this funeral happen in the very suburb of Moscow. So it's important to know that it's a suburb. It's a long way to come there from, let's say, the center of the city. And of course, it happened just a day after the address of Putin, which was his main pre-election address to the nation. So that's why the authorities were not interested to attract too much attention to the funeral. The fact that more than 20,000 people came to this funeral in the suburbs, in the situation of fear, in the situation where everyone of these people could be arrested, prosecuted, and so on. So it's really amazing, because it's the first time during this, let's say, 2 years after the start of the war, when we saw such a big opposition rally in the city, and in Russia in general.
Was the family able to get an independent autopsy? The Kremlin said that he died of natural causes. Navalny, of course, was 47 years old.
So first thing to say that Navalny was tortured in prison. So he spent more than 200 days in so-called prison cell. So it's a prison inside the prison with extremely hard conditions. And we still don't know for sure the reasons of his death, if it was the result of torture or it was the outcome of the poisoning. But for me, it's quite clear that anyway he was killed, because what we saw, it was a murder which happened consistently during his prison term.
You write in your Jacobin piece, and now after the murder of Navalny and faced with the rise of authoritarian forms of capitalism around the world, we must remember that without basic freedom of speech and assembly, the left and the oppressed have very little chance of winning anything. Do you hold out hope in Russia? I mean, you have Navalny's wife, Yulia, saying she's going to take on the mantle. What about forms of leadership within Russia that are dissenting, the other forms of opposition?
The success of Navalny as the leader that unified opposition, that was able to start mobilizations, mass mobilizations in Russia, it's all happened before the war. When he was poisoned in 2020, and after it, he understood that the only way to continue his activity as a public leader is to come back to the country. So for now, we have the situation in Russia, which is totally different with what was before the war. So for now, we live in the open, let's say, dictatorship, where any forms of public disobedience are forbidden. And of course, for Yulia Navalny, it will be very hard to present herself as the alternative leader being outside of the country. But on the other side, that's the only opportunity for the moment to speak publicly, to address Russian audience with open anti-war, anti-Putin slogans is to be in abroad. I think your position is very controversial in the sense. It's very challenging.
Finally, Ilya, your thoughts on this second anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Russian army sustained nearly 30,000 casualties in February alone, making it the bloodiest month for Russia since the war began. And you have the Ukrainian President Zelensky hinting at a potential focus on occupied Crimea this year. Put those together.
For now, we have the situation where the Russian army is taking initiative. Because Russia definitely has much more arms, it has much more people to mobilize to turn into soldiers, and the situation for Ukraine is not very promising for the moment. For Russia, the goals of this war is still very unclear, because if you follow Russian propaganda, if you follow statements of some people around Putin, you can see that they're openly talking about how to occupy Kyiv, how to occupy Odessa. Today, there was a lecture, public lecture of the former president Dmitry Medvedev, how to divide Ukraine into parts. Some part will go to Poland, another part will go to Romania, and the main part of Ukraine, together with Odessa and Kharkov, will go to Russia. So you see clearly that Russia is ready to continue this war. It was very clear from Putin's address a week ago. So I think that situation is very clear. If Ukraine will be not supported from the West, Russia will continue its offensive and realize its final goal, the elimination of Ukraine as a state.
Ilya Budryatskis, I want to thank you for being with us. Russian historian and political theorist, previously based in Moscow, has just joined University of California, Berkeley, as a visiting scholar. We'll link to your piece on Jacobin. Alexei Navalny taught Russia's opposition how to mobilize. When we come back, we go to Alabama to speak with a journalist and artist who had been undergoing IVF treatments and was preparing to transfer her frozen embryos when the Alabama State Supreme Court ruled frozen embryos should be considered children. She just met with Vice President Kamala Harris. Stay with us. South Got to Change by Adia Victoria. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Reproductive health and medical groups have asked the Alabama Supreme Court to revisit its recent ruling that frozen embryos should be considered children. The decision sent shockwaves through the world of reproductive medicine as legal experts and infertility specialists try to address the potential effects on access to IVF, that's in vitro fertilization, and other fertility treatments. The defendants in the lawsuit, the Center for Reproductive Medicine and the Mobile Infirmary, on Friday filed a petition, and the Medical Association of the State of Alabama and the Alabama Hospital Association filed a brief in support. Last week, Alabama's Republican-controlled State House and Senate passed legislation to enact civil and criminal protections for IVF providers, but the bills do not change the classification of embryos as children. Neither bill even mentions the word embryo. This came after a single Republican senator blocked quick passage Friday of a bill to create federal protections for in vitro fertilization. The measure was introduced by Democratic Illinois Senator Tammy Duckworth, who had both of her daughters using IVF. This is Republican Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith of Mississippi who blocked the bill. But first, Senator Duckworth.
Women willing to go through expensive, painful medical treatments just for a chance to experience the smallest, most banal moments of parenthood. Just to have a newborn to swaddle, a baby whose diaper needs to be changed, a toddler who needs their shoes to be tied. And if you believe that they have the right to be called mom without also being called a criminal, then all you have to do to prove it is to let us pass this should be obvious legislation.
The court's holding in favor of the parents found that these frozen human embryos are children under Alabama law. It did not ban IVF, nor has any state banned IVF. The bill before us today is a vast overreach that is full of poison pills that go way too far, far beyond ensuring legal access to IVF.
The recent Alabama Supreme Court ruling stems from appeals cases brought by three couples whose frozen embryos at a reproductive clinic in Mobile, Alabama, were accidentally destroyed when a hospital patient dropped them on the floor. In a 7-2 decision, the Alabama Supreme Court ruled the couples can now sue the clinic for wrongful death. The decisions partly hinged on anti-abortion language added to the Alabama Constitution in 2018 that says the state recognizes the, quote, rights of the unborn child. Unquote. For more, we're joined in Birmingham, Alabama, by Abby Crane, journalist and artist who'd been undergoing IVF treatments for nearly 2 years and was preparing to transfer her frozen embryos when the Alabama State Supreme Court ruled that frozen embryos can be considered children. On Thursday, she traveled to the White House to meet with Vice President Kamala Harris for a private meeting. Abby Crane also reports on women and gender issues for the news outlet Reckon. We welcome you to Democracy Now, Abby. Can you start off by responding to the Alabama Supreme Court ruling and then talk about how it's affected you personally?
Hi, thanks for having me. When it first came out, I was aware of the ruling and what they were trying to do. And then on Wednesday, this past Wednesday, I saw on actually social media on Instagram that my clinic was pausing in response. My first reaction was just sheer rage. I was extremely angry and honestly fell apart for a little bit.
How does it affect what you're going through? I mean, I think what's missing in a lot of the coverage is what people go through when you undergo IVF. The hopes and dreams you have, but also physically what this means.
Sure. So I've been undergoing IVF for the past 2 years, but I've been receiving infertility treatment for the last 5 years. So the ups and downs of, you know, injecting yourself with hormones, the ways it affects your mental health, the ways it affects your physical body, the pain of the procedures, you constantly have to be in this, you know, when you're in it. I say I compartmentalize the hope. When I'm in it, I try to be present and hopeful. But, you know, when I've taken a pause on the procedures, I have to just put it away in order to, you know, put one front of the other and do something else. But I am so fortunate. I'm thankful that I was not in the middle of a procedure or on medication currently, or had a egg retrieval scheduled. I can't imagine the folks that were actually in the middle of treatment. But because, you know, we were gearing up to schedule a implantation, the fact that these men down the street from me who serve on the Alabama Supreme Court have more say over when I choose to become a mother right now than me. And that's the reality of things is I don't care how quickly that they resolve this, that they put in their exception for IVF, the damage has already been done to folks who are in this, to me personally.
Can
I really
you
think they kind of showed their cards?
Can you move your frozen embryos to another state?
I don't know that yet. Right now, all I've received from my clinic is just kind of the standard what they've been sending everybody, and I think what most people can access through press releases. Right now, I don't think there are places that will transport them from Alabama, just because I think the transportation companies are looking at things the same way the fertility clinics are, in which they could be liable for embryos that were damaged.
Can you talk about your meeting with Vice President Harris? What did you talk about? And what do you think of the fact that Congress is trying to protect IVF and that was blocked? Tammy Duckworth, the senator who had both her kids by IVF, and the Mississippi senator blocked it.
It's enraging. I found that out while, like, I think it was right after I had met with the vice president. But yeah, I got to have a one-on-one private meeting with her, talking to her about my experience, her talking about how important it is for folks like me to continue speaking on this and sharing our story and showing that the folks in power, they playing politics, it harms real life people and affects real, vulnerable, nuanced conversations between patients and doctors.
Abby, the Alabama Republican House Representative Terry Collins introduced an IVF protection bill into the Alabama State House. Now, you're supporting this legislation, but you're concerned about the record of the state rep, Collins, and other Alabama Republicans on reproductive rights.
Yeah, I believe I heard her on this program earlier. You know, she was, she did the 2019 Alabama bill that, or law that banned abortion should Roe v. Wade be overturned with no exceptions to rape and incest. And, you know, it got all into personhood. And I think the cognitive dissonance is enraging that, you know, I have interviewed this woman who has children and to talk about her beliefs on reproductive health, and you know she is insistent that life begins at conception, and I don't understand how these folks are pushing to have their cake and eat it too, in saying that, you know, these embryos, which weren't even referenced in the bill, like you said, are humans while any other reproductive health choice, including abortion and miscarriage, could be affected by Alabama's current laws on abortion.
Finally, Abby, you wrote in Glamour, "I want people reading this who don't live in Alabama to know that you're not special and you are not safe." We're going to begin part two of our conversation and put it online with that point. Abby Crane is based in Alabama in Birmingham. She's a journalist and artist with Reckon. She's been undergoing IVF treatments for nearly 2 years. She just met with Vice President Kamala Harris. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back with her online.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
yeah, baby. This is a noise of carpet. Shag of the week.